And before that, here on BBC Radio 4, Ian Peacock continues his exploration of creative genius. Today he'll discover how neuroscience is helping us to understand where creative ideas come from.
I reckon my right side is probably best. I've always liked my right.
You've always liked it?
It's like, it's a stronger side. You can feel it's clever as well.
Left.
What about the back of the front?
The back of the thing.
The frontal lobe.
Right at the back. That just seems to be where I live. Sort of about two-thirds towards the back.
One of the lobes. It depends on the left, right, or left side, or right side. I think it's middle lobe, I don't know.
Does it go between the lobes, do you think? Do you think the ideas tend to flow between the lobes, or stick in one lobe?
Between the lobes.
Top right-hand corner, that's where mine come from.
Like, why?
My eyes look up, like, that way.
Mine comes right from the front, because when I header a football, right, it goes through my brain.
Yeah, I know, but...
Yeah, you headed a ball there at the forehead, didn't you?
Your ideas don't come from there.
Well, mine do. Yours come from the top right-hand corner, and mine come from the front.
The public, unanimous on one thing. If you have an idea, it probably comes from your head. That's good to hear. But scientists are now beginning to locate precisely where our best and most creative ideas happen physically in the labyrinths of our brains, where our hidden genius lives. And the theory is, if we can do that, perhaps we can somehow unleash the dormant inner talent that probably nestles in all of us. Today, I'll be meeting the people who believe they can track down genius. For the last 20 years, Nancy Andreasen, Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Iowa, has been trying to get a precise picture of the creative brain.
I think neuroscience can take us to the essence of creativity. We are living in a time when we have a bunch of amazing tools that permit us to understand the living brain and to ultimately be able to examine people who are highly creative and measure and visualize their brains while they're thinking and potentially while they're even creating. Creativity is the most fascinating gift that people have, and it's what's permitted us to emerge from being cavemen to being the complex human beings that we are in the 21st century. To understand how that happens is one of the most fascinating journeys we can take. What is it in us human beings that permits us to be original and advance knowledge in society? And one of the most powerful metaphors for that I know of is a poem by Coleridge called Kubla Khan, or A Vision in a Dream. And he talks about how Kubla Khan created this stately pleasure dome, and he actually talks about the creative process itself as a magical, violent, mystical process. And so the search for the essence of creativity is like being on the road to Xanadu. It's like trying to find something that no one has found as yet. It's sort of the ultimate voyage of discovery.
In Xanadu did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure dome decree, where Alph the sacred river ran through caverns measureless to man down to a sunless sea.
Well, one route to the Xanadu of creativity could be via conditions which are often viewed as negative. A recent book argued that 21 major creative figures, from Mozart to Lewis Carroll, had Asperger's syndrome. There are countless research papers on the relationship between creativity and neurosis, psychosis, autism, and bipolar disorder. Tommy McHugh from Birkenhead has none of these conditions, but he has experienced a seemingly miraculous metamorphosis. 5 years ago, he found himself speaking spontaneously in rhyming couplets, and compulsively writing poetry, sculpting, and painting. He now makes works of art from dawn till dusk, 7 days a week.
I work with clay and make clay heads. I work with candles and make candle heads and figurines. And I work with bone, paper mache, charcoal, poetry, upside down, inside out. I'd work with anything.
Tommy thinks nothing of working for 10 hours non-stop on a bit of sandstone or a giant mural covering an entire wall, and he sleeps 3 hours a night if he's lucky. This was all sparked off by a subarachnoid hemorrhage, a bleed between his brain and his skull. Before the hemorrhage, he wasn't remotely interested in art. Neuroscientist Dr. Michelle DeHaan.
he developed really an obsessive, intense interest in creating things. And so he would, for example, spend all night painting murals on his kitchen wall. It's a process that he feels he just cannot stop doing. Even, you know, at certain points, he just has to stay up all night till he completes something, always looking for the next thing. And he describes it as just being able to see a potential artwork in everything that he sees. So as you can imagine, it keeps him quite busy.
It's like I can't stop these creative ideas that are coming from me. It's like an addiction to creativity that I can't stop. They're like, imagine the volcano popping fairy liquid bubbles out. Them bubbles are ideas and I'm popping them. I'm so filled with the ideas that I wish they'd stop. I wish I could put a cork in it, but I can't. And four and a half years later on, I still can't. I look at the trees, I can put images in the trees. I'd like to bend the branches and shape them so I've got facial features in them, but they're growing. I'm looking in that curtain, I can see a face forming in that curtain. I can look at the creases in it.
What does it look like?
Well, it's just a face, it's a nose, a mouth. I can see the mouth, the nose, the eyes. The last home I was in, I couldn't look at the floor anymore because coming over the floor were millions of faces.
We were interested in the idea that maybe part of the reason for these abilities coming out was that to some extent they were sort of there or waiting to come out before, but that there were other aspects of Tommy's behavior and thinking that were sort of controlling those areas, and so they were not sort of dominating. And that part of his the damage of his brain may have sort of released those abilities.
It's opening up portions of my brain that were never opened up before.
Do you think that eventually this will subside and you'll not necessarily go back to your old self, but you'll stop getting this compulsion?
No. The compulsion is endless. It's as soon as I finish these two pieces of sandstone, I'm looking for more sandstone. I want a piece of sandstone as big as a gatepost so I can do a full human being. It's like there's nothing that I don't want to have a go at. It's not shut-off points here. I can't shut it off. As soon as you've gone, and we're attacking the sandstone, it's like if we're in the Sahara Desert and we're looking for drops of water, I could crave him for it.
If you wanted to stop doing this, could you sit down and stop and think, right,
no, I'd die. It'd be like a bloodline pulled from me.
What about talking in rhyme? What about the rhymes? The rhymes seem to be very much part of this.
Yeah, I can really make a rhyme out of everything. I had to learn to stop it.
Give me an example of talking in rhyme. Can you do that?
Well, I have the urge all the time to try and keep these bubbles in line. But they're popping and whopping each day so fast, I thought they'd end, but it looks like they're going to last. I'm working on sandstone. I'm filing and grounding each day, and the images are changing in every way. I find them connected in the ring. I want to make them perfect so they sing. I want people to see what's in the work, so they be positive, don't have a negative shake.
Tommy didn't stop creating his art for a minute while I was with him. He was constantly twiddling with the sculptures and adding bits to the huge chalk horse he's drawn on the wall above the mantelpiece. Every square inch of the house is emblazoned with art. Clearly, the hemorrhage opened a floodgate of ideas. It's as if the part of his brain that had, until then, been controlling, censoring his genius, was now switched off. Poet laureate Andrew Motion says his inspiration also seems to come from a mysterious, uncensored part of his brain.
Writing with me starts from a very, very long way back in my head. I'm very struck when I'm writing poems by how the wish to write a poem first suggests itself as an almost entirely non-verbal event. So I get this feeling and I then try and drag it or persuade it to come towards the better lit front of my mind. And as that change takes place, words begin to attach themselves to it. Having persuaded it to come from the dark back of my mind into the better lit part of my mind where words do begin to attach themselves to it, then I will start thinking about subjects that I've got lying around in my head at any given time, because perhaps this thing will suit that. But it feels as though one stage of it flows into the next.
It's interesting that Andrew talks about ideas moving from one part of the brain to another. Nancy Andreasen says creativity is a happy product of the way our brains are organised and how their different structures have to communicate with one another.
There are regions in the brain that are dedicated to specific functions. For example, we have visual cortex at the back of our brains in the occipital lobe that permits us to see, and we have auditory cortex, which permits us to hear. But we also have in our brain areas that are called association cortex, and those areas are not dedicated to a specific function. They are dedicated to connecting things together. And when someone does something creative, they are drawing heavily on that association cortex. For ordinary creativity, as in speech, as in, you know, say what I'm doing right now and you're doing right now, the association cortex is very active. I believe that when creative people are thinking truly original thoughts, their association cortex goes into a state of great disorganization, kind of like what is described in Kubla Khan.
But, oh, that deep romantic chasm which slanted down the green hill athwart a cedarn cover, a savage place, as holy and enchanted as e'er beneath a waning moon was haunted by woman wailing for her demon lover. And from this chasm, with ceaseless turmoil seething, as if this earth in fast thick pants were breathing, a mighty fountain momently was forced, amid whose swift...
And while it's in that state, ideas collide with one another, thoughts, sounds, and so on, and while all that chaotic violence is occurring, finally the brain self-organizes to produce an original thought. There are many examples of introspective accounts of how creative people come to their original ideas. And it's almost invariable. Creative people say, I can't make it happen. You cannot force creativity. The best way to achieve it is just to let your thoughts flow freely.
Poetry is a mysterious, intrinsically mysterious process, because I think it requires a balance between sides of our mind that inevitably produces something that you can't entirely explain. Clearly, when you're writing a poem, you need to have a part of your mind engaged that can look after the business end. So you have a part of your mind in play which is thinking about form, which is thinking about structure, and a side of your mind which I think is frankly like the primeval swamp, up through which rise bubbles that are full of your deepest hurts and hopes and anxieties and loves and yearnings and losses and all those things. I think that the swamp side of the equation is the mysterious one.
Do we all have a swamp?
I think we do all have a swamp. What varies considerably is our access to it.
Tommy's clearly accessed his, and he's convinced we'll all be able to plunder our creative swamps in the future.
I reckon in 20 odd years' time or more, if they haven't even done it now, they'll be able to get a cap that I'll put on. I'll get an electric impulse to a certain part of my brain which will say to me, Tommy, you're a wonderful cook, get that shift in air going. Then I'll get another cap with another tchung, you're an artist, Tom. What's it going to come to? You know, the future, that's what it's going to be. What else could it be?
The thinking cap idea is to give a person a momentary view of the world the way it is.
Alan Snyder of the University of Sydney.
That would be what we would dream of, that we could look at the world without our prejudices.
Professor Snyder is director of the Centre for the Mind, and he's developed a real thinking cap, an electromagnetic hat that can be used to slow down or stimulate different parts of the brain, even boost or suppress its left or right half or hemisphere. He says this can help people to be more creative by allowing them to perceive sights, sounds and language without the usual mental sensors, prejudices and fixed mindsets. The thinking cap makes its wearers rather like so-called autistic savants, people with autism who seem to have a different way of seeing the world.
To me, autism is the state of seeing the world the way it is. And on its own, that is not creative. But if you can temporarily be, for one moment, see the world the way it is and then snap back to your conceptual self, you have the advantage of not only being able to link disparate ideas into a new synthesis, but you can see that the dots, the way they are, you can see ways of joining them up that haven't been thought of before. It's very hard to look at the cloud and see something that you don't know. Essentially, I'm inhibiting a particular region of one hemisphere, the left hemisphere, with the belief that it activates or disinhibits, stops inhibiting the right. So, oversimplistically, whereas you're not conscious of the right normally, you're more conscious of the left, now you become more conscious of the right. And that's an oversimplistic view, but that's the way I would look at it.
So we can become more creative by temporarily switching off our existing structures of knowledge, getting rid of the intellectual clutter, and seeing the world afresh. But Professor Snyder's thinking caps aren't available on the high street yet, so I decided to opt for a somewhat more relaxing technique of channeling my creativity.
The shadow of the dome of pleasure floated midway on the waves, where was heard the mingled measure from the fountain and the caves. It was a miracle of rare device, a sunny pleasure dome with caves of ice, a damsel with a dulcimer in a vision once I saw.
Actually, it wasn't a damsel with a dulcimer. It was Professor Nancy Andreasen again, with an explanation of the creative state which Coleridge was possibly in when he wrote Kubla Khan, the Xanadu poem. Coleridge said he'd just woken up from a deep sleep.
When people are in this state of mind, actually I kind of jokingly call it random episodic silent thought, or rest. When people are in this state of reverie, where thoughts are occurring randomly, that is when they are able to think freely, without inhibition, without censorship, and, you know, ideas collide, and sometimes they bounce off each other, but sometimes they collide and form links to one another. And then something that didn't exist before emerges from their thought processes. That happens best when in reverie or in rest, random episodic silent thought. My favorite way to think is to stretch out on the bed and just, I'm staring at the ceiling, but I'm not seeing anything. And people who know me know I'm almost in a trance-like state. For me, the metaphor is a little bit like diving down very, very deeply and floating around underneath the surface of the ocean. And then if somebody wants to bother me while I'm doing that, I have to swim all the way back to the surface and answer some dumb question.
And this reverie has a name, the hypnagogic state.
This is the border between waking and sleeping. And there's also something called the hypnopompic state, which is where you're waking up.
John Griselier, Professor of Psychology at Imperial College London.
But these are known to be very conducive to having really quite creative insights. So Jean Cocteau, for example, often had the full scenario of a play on waking in his case.
What exactly is happening during this state? Could you maybe take me through the line that goes from being asleep to being awake?
Well, the level of consciousness is altered. And to do that, the rhythmic activity in the brain is slowing down. And in deep stages of sleep, this cycles very slowly at 1, 2, or 3 cycles per second. In the hypnagogic state, it's just slightly more frequent than that, between 3 and 7 cycles per second.
Massenet, Tartini and Robert Louis Stevenson all created classics while they were in a hypnagogic state. And chemist Dmitri Mendeleev thought up the periodic table when he was half asleep. Jean Griselier argues that to be truly creative, we should get our brains into a similar sort of reverie and adjust our brainwaves from faster alpha waves to slower theta ones.
One of the crucial principles in understanding creativity is making unusual associations that you haven't made before and having the insightful aha experience. Now, what that is going to require is making connections in the brain between memories that haven't been connected before. The slower the activity, the further it travels in the brain. So the theta state connects up distant parts of the brain which are not connected up when we're actively thinking.
John's developed a special training program which helps professionals from surgeons to musicians to boost their theta waves and therefore think and perform more creatively. At the Royal College of Music, it dramatically improved the performance of solo musicians.
Today, we have one of our stars from the Royal College of Music series of studies, Cassie Yukawa, who is part now of an international piano duo. And what we're going to do with her is put her through the theta training program, which was the one that was most successful in enhancing artistry at the Royal College of Music.
What results do you get from that? Did you have quantifiable results in terms of improved performance and creativity?
Well, the improvement was remarkable in order of magnitude terms. It was actually equivalent to two class grades or two classes of degree honours, in fact.
Gosh, so leaping from a 2-2 to a first.
Exactly.
John doesn't use a thinking cap, but he does put little electrodes on your earlobes and on the top of your head to monitor whether you're thinking in alpha or in theta waves. If you achieve creative theta waves by relaxing, you hear a pleasant, natural sound. If you're still thinking in alpha waves, your brain sets off a busier and rather less soothing noise.
The alpha wave will be paired with a babbling brook sound, and the theta wave with waves crashing on the shore. Now, both these are good sounds to hear, and the brain likes this, and so we'll turn on more of these rhythms so the sounds come on more.
So there's a kind of circular inspiration going on.
That's right.
And her objective is to get these crashing waves and get rid of the babbling brook.
Well, they're both good, but we want to hear more of the waves than the brook.
Cassie, how are you feeling when you walked in here? I mean, you've come off one of the busiest roads in London. How would you say your brain waves were doing?
Well, I guess they were pretty active. I came in and I just had many conversations with various friends, catching up with news, so lots of gossip going on. So, you know, I was just kind of feeling quite happy, really.
Right. So you're happy, but you're not totally relaxed. You're not at your most creative.
Well, I'm very excitable at the moment. Yeah, this is how I'm feeling right now.
What are you thinking about?
I was thinking actually about my guinea pigs.
Right. So you're happy, but you're not totally relaxed. You're not at your most
creative. Well, I'm very excitable at the moment. Yeah, this is how I'm feeling right now.
And so on with Cassie's electrodes. Out with the guinea pigs, in with the babbling brook. Then we hope the open sea.
The theta rhythm oscillates between 3 and 7 cycles per second. So that then travels over a wide distance in the brain. So memories laid down in those different distal areas can then actually be associated together in working memory, which would then be reflected in the conscious experience that she would be having. So there will be thoughts going through her mind, there will be images perhaps going through her mind at the same time.
I've just been on this incredible journey into myself, and I think as I was increasing the wave sounds, it was as though I was sort of distancing myself from myself. The fairground wheels, you know, you see it speeding up, and in the beginning you see the individual compartments, everyone sitting on the wheel, and then as it gets faster and faster, it's not as though they're not still turning, but it turns into a blur and it looks like a still circle. It's almost as though it's like that. I mean, I could be thinking of a million things, yet it's as though I'm thinking of nothing, but I know that all those little compartments of my wheel are turning very fast, but I feel still.
So how does this translate into performing?
In a way, I guess it's taking a specific sensation I have when I'm on stage away from the concert hall. So it's as though, in a way, I'm flexing those muscles without having the physicality of playing the piano. So I'm freed up to sort of explore the mental realm of what it feels like for me when I'm on stage. It's as though you're just training a muscle that you probably, you know, like when you do some exercise and you come away aching, oh, I didn't know I had that muscle, and you sort of reacquaint yourself with having that. It's just like that, but it just happens to be in your brain. It's not.
So we have a metaphorical creativity muscle, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's just improving rather than, you know, totally bringing something new. It's just enhancing what you naturally have, but focusing on that specific part of your brain.
So we can really change our brains. We can rewire them. We can do very palpable things to them.
Well, I believe in the experience I've had, we're just improving what we already do. And some of us are very lucky that we have creative outlets for this, but I don't believe it's, you know, just limited to the arts. I think it's in whatever you do. It's just about a sense of well-being and sort of having a gateway to another sense of yourself.
So, whether your route is a magnetic thinking cap, sleep, or a machine which plays waves at you, the future of creative thinking does seem to lie in physically switching off the uptight parts of your brain, and thereby switching on your ability to see things afresh, then connect them with slow, fluid brainwaves. If you think about it, we do all seem to have a creative urge, whether it takes the form of baking cakes, writing a novel, doing graffiti, fiddling with little bits of blue tack, or perhaps making entries on a weblog. Could the 21st century be the age not of Aquarius, but of Xanadu?
The 21st century is going to be the century of biology, just as the last century was the century of physics. And within biology, neuroscience is tackling almost everything that there is to know and understand about the brain. And there are just a few of us who are pushing the envelope, trying to understand these highly complicated but very fascinating processes like creativity. And potentially I would predict that at some time in the future, we will find Xanadu. We will find how the creative brain creates. And we'll find out how the less extraordinarily creative brain thinks and be able to help it reach a little closer to Xanadu anyway.
In the next program, practical creativity techniques you can try at home, school, and in the office. But before that, time for me to don a pair of rather fetching headphones and slow my brain down to a dull roar. I can see the sea, which is marvellous. It's very, very loads of waves now.
Ooh.
I've gone a bit mad. So like one minute I'm in the sea, the next minute I'm in a stream full of tadpoles. It's a bit like being drunk without being drunk. Not that I've ever really been drunk before, really. I'm not 100% here. I'm in another place, and I prefer it, which is a bit scary.
And all should cry,
"Beware, beware!" His flashing eyes, his floating hair, weave a circle round him thrice, and close your eyes with holy dread, for he on honeydew hath fed, and drunk the milk of paradise.
Creative Genius was presented by Ian Peacock. The producer was Pamela Rutherford.